well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards, but I'm pretty sure you know that by now. Hope you had a great weekend. Thanks very much for tuning into the program. Always excited when we get a chance to have a fresh face here on the program. And while Joe Greenlee has been around working on Second Amendment issues for a number of years, I've not ever had him as a guest before, but Joe is now with the NRA ILA and is doing fantastic work on, I don't know how many cases he's actively involved in at the moment. But he was able to carve out a couple of minutes today to talk about a few cases that the NRA is involved in, a couple of them out of New Jersey, including one dealing with New Jersey's gun-free zones, where the NRA and its partners are asking the Third Circuit to take this case en banc. Another case dealing with New Jersey's ban on so-called assault weapons and large-capacity magazines that has already been taken en banc. And in fact, oral arguments coming up here in just a few days in that case. And then one of several prohibited persons cases that the Supreme Court's going to be considering conference this fall. I've written about five of these cases dealing with Section 922 G3, the unlawful users of drugs, not being able to possess firearms. So there are five of those cases. But then there's also a couple of other prohibited persons cases. So there's Vincent versus Bondi. It deals with a woman out of Utah who wrote a bad check close to 20 years ago, who has been denied her ability to own a firearm. And then there's Zerka versus Bondi. This one just filed a couple of weeks ago. The government has not even issued its response yet, but the NRA and its partners submitted an amicus brief urging the court to take this case and, again, address the question of whether nonviolent felons can be prohibited from possessing firearms without violating their Second Amendment rights. Obviously, you know, I think there's no dispute that some individuals who are prohibited of some or convicted of some crimes can be barred from possessing the right to keep their arms. I know that, you know, a lot of us say, hey, listen, once you've done the time, your rights should be automatically restored. But that's not the way the courts have looked at this issue. But again, we're not talking about individuals who are convicted of murder or armed robbery or, you know, a crime of violence. We're talking about a bad check, a falsifying of food stamp application, maybe a false income tax return. Should those crimes deem someone to be so dangerous that the only way for them to exercise their Second Amendment rights is to apply for relief through the DOJ and hope that the Attorney General says, okay, yes, you get to exercise your Second Amendment rights once again? An avenue, by the way, that has not been available for decades and may not be available once there's a change in administration, right? I mean, the DOJ has proposed this rule that would allow the Attorney General to oversee this program that has technically existed on paper for the past, since the Gun Control Act of 1968. But it was always the ATF that was running this program, and then it's been defunded for like 30 years. So there's been no way really to apply for relief. The Trump administration wants to change that. But again, this is through a rule. And that rule could be rescinded the next time there's an anti-gun president in office. So the broader question is not whether or not there are remedies available, but again, who can be prohibited by law from possessing a firearm? We will get to that, but we're going to start with the Garden State gun cases when we kick off the conversation with Joe Greenlee. Take a look and a listen. Joe, thanks so much for coming to the program. It's good to actually have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Well, listen, we're going to get right to it. There's so much to talk about, including a couple of cases out of New Jersey, which it provides fertile ground for Second Amendment groups like the NRA to challenge a host of gun laws. I got a release last week that the NRA has filed a petition for a rehearing en banc in a case called Siegel versus Plotkin, right? And this is a case that deals with the multiple sensitive places that New Jersey put into effect after Bruin, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So, and I believe there were something like 23 places that were designated as prohibited places.
Yes, with over 100, I think it's 115 subcategories. So there's something like 23 or 26 categories of sensitive places, and then over 100 subcategories. So pretty much you can't carry, there's hardly a square inch of public land in which you are able to lawfully carry a firearm in New Jersey.
And the district court judge and the Third Circuit panel, again, correct me if I'm wrong, said a few of these places, no, the state can't ban guns there, but they upheld the vast majority of these gun-free zones.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the vast majority, including places like stadiums and, you know, public events, parks, and just about everywhere you can name. We got a few wins there. For example, permit applicants had to acquire liability insurance in order to carry, that kind of stuff. A few things like that were struck down, but the overwhelming majority of it was upheld, unfortunately.
Okay, so I guess my first question is, why ask for an en banc, a rehearing of this case, instead of appealing straight to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, so a few reasons. So the Supreme Court so far has not shown much interest in taking cases on a preliminary injunction. This is still surprisingly is on preliminary injunction. It was argued, the opinion took about 2 years, nearly, I think about 23 months from the time it was argued at the Third Circuit till the time we got a decision. So it's hard to believe, but it's still at the PI stage. And the Supreme Court has shown and expressed a disinterest in cases at this stage, but they did just take the Wolford case last week. So, you know, maybe that's an encouraging sign that they'll be more open to these things. And then the en banc Third Circuit, it looks like it's going to be a favorable place. President Trump has added two more judges to the court in recent one last, well, she might be, Judge Mascot might be sworn in this week. She was confirmed by the Senate last week. And then, so we have a pretty favorable court there. So we're hoping they'll be open to taking this case and maybe reconsider the ruling of the panel.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And by the way, it's just bizarre to me and depressing to me that the Third Circuit is more favorable than the Fourth Circuit when it comes to Second Amendment issues, because the Fourth Circuit's where I live. So besides this case, which again, and that request was made last week, so there's no firm deadline for the court to respond to this reply or this request, is there?
No, there's not. You know, hopefully, typically, if they are interested, they'll require the state to respond and try to convince it not to take the case, you know, hear why it shouldn't rehear the case en banc. And then, but usually these things don't take very long for, you know, everything takes longer than everyone wants in Second Amendment litigation.
Right.
But relatively, these things are decided pretty quickly whether or not to rehear the case. So I think, you know, within a month or two, we should know.
Okay. Now, also in Third Circuit news and also in New Jersey news, before we get away from this, what's going on with the challenge to New Jersey's ban on so-called assault weapons in large capacity magazines?
Yeah. So this one's very interesting. We have a case that's been consolidated with an FPC, I believe, SAF case. Our case is the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs versus Plackin, and that challenges New Jersey's assault firearm ban and ban on 10 plus round magazines. And then the FPC, and I think SAF is in there, I hope I'm not getting that wrong, their case is Cheeseman, and that challenges the assault firearm ban. These were consolidated. And the district court, this was the bizarre ruling at the district court where the district court's like, oh, you know, there's no history that justify it. First of all, it said, I'm not going to consider all assault firearms. I'm just going to consider the Colt AR-15, just that specific firearm. And there's no history that supports banning a common weapon like that. And then the court moved on to the magazines and was like, you know what? History, that same history does support banning common weapons here, common arms. And so really bizarre. Whatever the Third Circuit does, it's not going to do that. So anyway, went up to the Third Circuit. They heard a panel of perhaps some might say an unfavorable panel to the Second Amendment, heard oral arguments. I think that was July 1st. And then, you know, about 40 days later or so, before that panel issued an opinion, the court sua sponte on its own doing took the case en banc, and which I'm hoping is an encouraging sign. So the Third Circuit, I think, is one of only two circuit courts, the Tenth Circuit being the other, that has this pre-publication circulation of opinion. So before an opinion goes out, they circulate it to all the judges. So only three judges are on the initial panel of a court that hears a case typically, and but they'll circulate it to all the judges of the court. And so what we're hoping is that what the court did here, the other judges saw perhaps an unfavorable opinion getting ready to come out and stepped in and said, you know what, let's take this en banc, and that we will now get a favorable ruling. But, you know, that's a lot of optimism in there.
Well, I mean, but not unreasonable optimism, as you say, when you're doing the head count, right? And we've seen other good, this is not just a matter of, okay, well, who appointed what judges, right? I mean, we've seen some favorable decisions from the Third Circuit, even going back to like Range versus Garland, where the Third Circuit said, no, somebody who lied on a food stamp application 20 plus years ago shouldn't be forevermore denied the right to keep and bear arms. Like, that doesn't fit with the national tradition of gun ownership. So we've seen other good decisions out of the Third Circuit.
Yeah, exactly. And there have been Biden appointees. And by the time, you know, Range went up en banc twice, I think the first time there were one or two Biden appointees who joined with the, you know, generally Republican majority there, mm-hmm. Republican appointed majority. And then by the time it went, it got remanded after it must have been Rahimi. And then they considered it en banc again, and that was an overwhelmingly, there were only, I think, two, if I remember correctly, two dissenting judges on the entire court. So, yeah, it's looking like a promising place to be right now in the Third Circuit, and hopefully that bears out here in the oral arguments in the New Jersey Magazine assault firearm cases on I think 2 days here.
Wow, okay.
On Wednesday.
And it's interesting, too, because we saw the Fourth Circuit. I just mentioned the Fourth Circuit a little bit ago. They did the same thing with the Snope case, right? We had had a 3-judge panel. They heard oral arguments. More than a year goes by. From what I understand, this was going to be a 2-1 decision in favor of the plaintiffs, striking down Maryland's ban on so-called assault weapons and large-capacity magazines. They were waiting on that dissenting judge to come out with their decision so they could all get published. And then the panel, the Third or Fourth Circuit, rather, says, sua ponte, you know what, we're going to take this case. And they come out with their own decision declaring that unusually dangerous weapons are not protected by the Second Amendment, that AR-15s are like machine guns, and so they're not protected. It was an awful, awful decision. I'm hopeful that the Third Circuit is going to rule differently, not only because it would create a circuit court split, which might make it more likely that the Supreme Court does hear one of these cases, but, you know, again, I mean, we are talking about, as the judge got it right in terms of, you know, AR-15s, commonly owned firearms. Now, I don't want to get too in the weeds here, Joe, but how did the judge get to that point where he said, okay, yes, the Colt AR-15 is protected by the Second Amendment, but large capacity magazines that can hold more than 10 rounds, which are even more common than Colt AR-15 rifles are not protected by the Second Amendment. What was the logic the judge used there?
Really was not much. He looked at, with all due respect to the judge, he looked at the same exact history and said, you know, Bowie knife, concealed carry restrictions from the 19th century and stuff like that, and said, well, these aren't bans. These are just, you know, restrictions on the manner in which you can carry. These can't justify a ban on common arms. And then went to magazines, said these are common arms, and then went through the same history as if the first analysis for the Colt AR-15 never occurred, and said, yeah, this justifies a ban here. So there was no like differentiating, like, oh, these are different from Colt AR-15s for this reason or that. It was almost like two separate analyses conducted by two separate people kind of glumped together into one opinion.
That is wild. All right. Well, let's hope we get a better reasoned and a better outcome there from the Third Circuit en banc. Now, we got you here. I also want to ask you about a case that the NRA is involved in, at least with an amicus brief, right? This is a case, Zerka versus Bondi. It's one of multiple cases dealing with prohibited persons that the Supreme Court will be considering, at least in conference this term. And NRA filed an amicus brief in support of Mr. Zerka. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Mr. Zerka was pleaded guilty to a financial crime over a decade ago. And so the crime was punishable by imprisonment of more than 1 year. So he falls under the federal felon ban, 18 USC 922G. And he's forever prohibited from possessing a firearm. And so the Second Circuit denied his request to have his rights restored and ruled that, you know, felons, nonviolent or not, no matter how long ago it occurred, whether the offense involved violence or anything like that, like, no matter what, if you're a felon, you can't even challenge this law, how it applies to you. And so Mr. Zirka has petitioned the Supreme Court to hear the case, and we filed an amicus brief along with Second Amendment Foundation, Firearms Policy Coalition, and FPC Action Foundation, urging the court to hear the case.
And we're waiting to see the government's reply. I guess they've got a few weeks left before they have to reply. But, there's some similarities to another case called Vincent versus Bondi, or maybe it's Bondi versus Vincent. Melinda Vincent lives out in Utah. Again, I think it was a couple decades ago, maybe 17 years ago. She wrote a bad check for, I think, about $500. She was convicted of a federal felony, of sentenced to probation. At the time, she was a homeless drug addict. She has since turned her life around. She's actually a drug counselor now. She works with the state of Utah. As a single mom, she wants to be able to own a pistol for self-defense. She'd like to be able to maybe go, shoot with her kids. But again, she can't because of this nonviolent felony conviction nearly two decades ago. The government did reply in that case, and I'm wondering if we're not going to see a similar reply to the Zirka cert petition. And the DOJ's position with Melinda Vincent was that the statute is generally constitutional, certainly facially constitutional. And, we've got this new program rolling out where people who are prohibited can apply for relief. And so there's no reason for the court to take this case because Melinda Vincent can always apply for relief. It seems to me like that's dodging the question, right? The question isn't whether or not somebody should be able to apply for relief. The question is whether or not the law itself is unconstitutional, not what sort of relief from disabilities there might be available.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm glad that they have this new revitalized administrative process under 18 USC 925C that allows people who have been rightfully disarmed, because they committed some violent act and hopefully they turn themselves around and can, get their rights back. But it's not an appropriate remedy for somebody who should have never been disarmed in the first place. So nonviolent felons, the fact that they can go now and, apply, potentially get their rights back if the government feels so inclined, is I think just inappropriate and unconstitutional as applied to somebody who should still have and have never lost their right to bear arms.
Yeah, and there are, I think, five cases dealing with 922G3, the unlawful users of drugs. Five different cases that are pending before the Supreme Court in conference on that particular issue. But this is a different subsection of 922G, right? So this is a different statute that is used. This is one that just says if you've been convicted of a crime that's punishable by more than 1 year in prison, then no more Second Amendment for you.
Yeah, yes, that's right. The G3 cases are interesting in that it's somewhat similar rationale. The courts have been applying this dangerousness standard, which is historically accurate, that people were disarmed if they have demonstrated there's a proven proclivity for violence or something. And there's some overlap in the analysis courts have been applying to the felon bans and illegal drug user bans. But some courts have taken different routes. But anyway, yes, that's a different subsection of the statute. But the same rationale still applies, I think, in that, if you're a peaceable person, you can't be disarmed. And the history bears that out.
Obviously I agree with you. I think there's something like a four-way circuit court split on this issue because you've got, some courts just like the Second Circuit just upholding the law in toto. You've got other circuits, including I think the Third Circuit, that says, well, there's a dangerous standard. But then the question becomes, all right, well, what is that standard and how do we apply that standard? So it seems like this is an issue that the Supreme Court, they're not forced to take any particular case, but it seems like this one, there's enough confusion in the lower courts that there really needs to be some sort of definitive statement by SCOTUS about, okay, here's how to apply what we've said in Heller, McDonald, and Bruin to these types of cases.
Yes, absolutely. It's there's some chaos in the lower courts over the felon ban and the illegal drug user ban, and six circuits now, and it's a developed, cemented split here where six circuits don't even allow you to come in. Like Miss Vincent that you mentioned in the 10th circuit, she can't even come in and say, I wrote a, false check to a grocery store 17 years ago for groceries and, turned my life around to advanced degrees and successful entrepreneur and all that stuff. It doesn't matter. You can't even come in no matter what your facts are. And then the third, fifth, and sixth circuits, say, yeah, you know, you can come in. These are your constitutional rights, and the government has to prove that it is able to disarm you. And, you know, that's just in the felon case. And then the Fifth Circuit has been applied a similar analysis, a dangerousness analysis to illegal drug users, and struck down the ban many times for marijuana users. And a lot of those are up there. I would keep an eye on the U.S. versus Humani case, which has by far the worst set of facts.
Yeah.
And the government in all these cases that get up there, they're like, you should hear this case. It's an important issue, but take that case with the worst facts possible. So keep an eye on that one.
Yeah. That you're right. You've got a lot of cases where the defendant, I think, is maybe a little more, what's the word? Sympathetic, I guess. Mr. Humani's facts, not quite as sympathetic, kind of not necessarily a Zaki Rahimi individual, but it is interesting that, you know, the DOJ has taken a lot of really good steps to defend our Second Amendment rights. But in this particular issue, they are urging the Supreme Court to take the defendant that probably is the least sympathetic out of the five here.
I agree. And that's no accident, I don't think, when it comes to this issue.
I suspect that you're right. Well, listen, Joe, as always, I should say as always, is the first time we've ever done this. But thank you for coming on the program. I hope that this is just the first time of many conversations that we get to have with you.
Yes, I hope so, too. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Joe Greenlee joins us from NRA's Institute for Legislative Action here on NRA. On Bearing Arms, Cameron Company. Going back old school. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
My thanks to Joe for joining me on the program. It was great talking with him. Look forward to doing this again very soon. Right now, though, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a story out of Staten Island. SI Live reporting, I guess this was Queens technically, but the story itself comes from SI Live. Suspect with 45 prior arrests charged in Queens mother's hit and run death. The hit and run in question, by the way, took place last March, March 22nd. But Timothy Bowler, age 31, was just arrested last Friday in connection with the death of 52-year-old Lilawati Nareen, who was struck by a motorcycle. According to SI Live, Bowler was already in custody at Rikers Island on charges stemming from a machete attack that severed a Metropolitan Transit Authority worker's fingers, according to the New York Post. Back last March, police say that Nareen was standing at an intersection when she was struck by a motorcycle allegedly driven by Bowler, who then fled on foot after the collision. She was taken to Jamaica Hospital in critical condition, died less than 3 weeks later. She had recently been declared cancer-free after completing chemotherapy for breast cancer. Her son said that her doctors had encouraged her to walk for exercise. Bowler's now facing charges, including leaving the scene of an accident resulting in death, as well as operating without a license in connection with Nareen's death. And court records show that Bowler has accumulated 45 prior arrests. Now, not all of these are convictions, but arrests anyway, including charges for assault, rape, weapons possession, unlawful surveillance related to a domestic violence case. And then again, this most recent case, Bowler accused of menacing and assaulting a MTA worker named Taekwon Young in a Bronx bodega back on January the 24th. The victim in that case had four fingers severed in the attack, which started, according to the New York Post, when the men's dogs got into an altercation while they were walking them. As a result of his injuries, Young lost his job as an MTA bus cleaner. And again, a Bowler taken into custody. So 45 arrests. Again, don't know how many convictions to his name, but let's say the number is zero. That's a problem in and of itself, right? You got the wrong guy 45 times. I doubt it. So how many of these cases were resolved by plea bargains? How many of these cases could have resulted in prison time, but didn't result in prison time? So this individual's out where he was allegedly able to strike this woman on a motorcycle and killing her as a result. I'm guessing the question is far too many of those cases. Now, today's Armed Citizen story comes from South Carolina, where a shooting at a mall in Rock Hill was deemed self-defense by police. This happened, I think it was on Friday. Officers responded to the mall about 2 p.m., found a 26-year-old man with a gunshot wound to the shoulder. He was taken to a local hospital for treatment. The individual who pulled the trigger was found nearby and detained, but the Rock Hill PD says its investigation revealed that the shooter was accosted by the man both verbally and physically, and that the armed citizen used his own firearm lawfully for protection, so no charges will be filed. I don't have a lot of information other than there was this verbal dispute that escalated into physical violence that led to the armed citizen, again, drawing a firearm and shooting in self-defense. The 26-year-old who was shot, identified, as Martrell Telly Minter, now charged with a third-degree assault and battery, and he will have a court date upon his release from medical care. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, while unable to do the right thing, a trio of young men who saved an elderly woman who drove her car into the water at a Louisiana boat launch. This was just outside of Baton Rouge in Cutoff, Louisiana. Jacques Bilio, Nathan Bilio, and their friend Brady Dufresne, all 20 years old, get ready to pick up their boat last Thursday, October the 9th. And while they were there at that boat launch, they saw this car go straight into the water. The three men immediately jumped into the water, pulled an elderly woman out of her vehicle, according to the LaForce Parish Fire District 3 spokesperson. After she was rescued, firefighters got there. They searched the vehicle for any other occupants. Didn't find anybody, thankfully. But LaForce Parish Fire District 3 thanking the trio for their heroism and courage, saying thanks to the quick and selfless response of these three young men, a life was saved tonight. The situation could have ended in tragedy, but their bravery made all the difference. And again, I mean, talk about being in the right place at the right time. If these three young men had not been there, getting ready to take their boat out of the water, this woman may have driven in to the water and nobody would have been around to see her. Nobody would have been around to rescue her. This could have been an unspeakable tragedy. But again, thanks to Jacques Bilio, Nathan Bilio, and Brady Dufresne, the woman is safe and sound. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com today. We are keeping you abreast of all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Actually, we just rolled out some great stuff going along with our VIP Platinum membership, so you can get all of your stories from all of the Town Hall websites in one location, all the podcasts, including Bearing Arms Cam and Company. It's all right there for you. It's a great layout. You can contact writers directly. But no matter what tier of support you choose, we do thank you very much for the support that you're providing Bearing Arms. We could not do this without you, so thank you again. All right, enjoy the rest of your Monday, as well as Mondays can be enjoyed. We'll see you back here for 2-8 Tuesday. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.